Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
Doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Today on the show, we have Josh Hicks, a candidate for Kentucky House in the 45th District in Fayette County, the southwest corner of Fayette County.
A UK law alum like me.
There you go. And you know what? Now that we've interviewed both him and Carolyn DuPont, we have now interviewed everybody seeking as a Democrat to represent the Bluegrass Airport. So there you go. All right. In addition to speaking to him, which I thought really went well, he's a very passionate guy.
Yeah, he is.
And we overcame our headphone difficulties to record this with Mr. Hicks. It was very good to speak with him, but we have some other stuff we want to talk about beforehand. Jasmine is going to update us on the status of all the bills that we've talked about so far during the session. There's two legislative days left, not much time. We probably have a good sense about what will and what won't pass. And then I will be talking a little bit about vetoes and signatures, and then we have quick hits. So, Jasmine, without any further ado, tell us about the bills we talked about already.
All right. I'm sure that all the listeners have been wondering what happened to HB 609, the gas tax bill, and what happened to the child marriage bill. I'm sure they've been waiting in anticipation for an update.
Don't make fun of our audience like that, Jasmine.
Okay. So, I'm going to kind of summarize what's happened with all the bills that we've talked about here on the show during this session. So first we have Senate Bill 151, which is the sewage turned pension bill, which we know passed the House just barely 49-46 and then passed the Senate 22-15. It was signed by the governor this week, which has triggered a potential rally that's planned for Friday. And several school districts were here at Wednesday right now, and lots of school districts have already canceled school for Friday.
Right.
So I think that there will be a big turnout in Frankfort to protest the signing of this bill. Next major bill, the tax bill and the budget bill, the governor vetoed both of them. Robert is going to tell us all about it later. It's a pretty exciting story, I guess. But this can be overridden. The veto can be overridden, but if it's not, they're going to have a special session and pass a budget.
Yeah.
Right? Because you have to pass a budget every 2 years. Next up is HB 302, which is the Open Records and Personal Communications Bill. It was a bill already, but then kind of at the last minute, there was a provision added by Damon Thayer that exempted communications from personal devices from open records. And that bill passed the House, went to the Senate, and then that's when the provision was added. And the last action that's happened is it's been received in the House Rules Committee, but there hasn't been any further action on it.
Yeah, that would be tough to pass because they would have to then pass it with the changes in the House and then send it back to the Senate.
Right.
So there's probably not enough time to do anything there.
Probably not. Next up is HB 6. That is the Rural Jobs and Tax Credit. So this is the one, Robert just talked about this a couple weeks ago. It's very similar to an angel investor tax credit.
It actually included the angel investor tax credit. It was added to this bill.
Oh, it was? Yeah, okay. So that bill passed in the House. There were several floor amendments filed in the Senate. Senate Democrats filed amendments to delete the original provisions, create an affordable housing credit, the amendment to add the angel investor tax credit. So
it looks like it's on the floor, though. So if it's on the floor, they can absolutely vote on it in the last couple of days. So that's something that could absolutely pass.
The next one is HB 609. That's the gas tax. That's the bill that would raise the statutory floor on wholesale gasoline and assess a hybrid vehicles tax. So I think Robert just talked about this one the same day that we talked about the Rural Jobs and Tax Credit Act. It's still sitting in the House Appropriations and Revenue Committee after a second reading.
Right. So it would have to pass both houses. Very, very difficult to do that in 2 days. So
not much time for that bill, which we liked.
Yeah, too bad. Shockingly, the bill we liked didn't go very far.
This was obviously one that I was very passionate about and did a whole segment on, HB 169. That was the gang bill, which brought in the definition of criminal gang activity, among other bad things like increasing penalties and sentences. So that bill passed the House, but then it was passed over in the Senate on April 2nd.
Yeah, this is one of the bill that I think most people are watching the most closely because I think that there is a high likelihood that it will be taken up and passed in the Senate.
HB 348, that's the judicial restructuring that we talked about. It adds a couple new family courts and restructures a few judicial districts. That was passed and signed by the governor on April 2nd. Like we talked about, this was something that was very needed, but it didn't go quite as far as the Chief Justice of Skokie wanted it to go.
Uh-huh.
But it certainly may be an improvement in some of the judicial caseload issues that we have.
Well, it is the law now. So there you go.
That's correct. HB 166, this is the medical marijuana bill. I think we kind of already talked about this. We did a segment on it after 3 days of hearings. It never came up for a vote.
Right.
And we told everyone that it was likely dead, and that is still the case.
Yeah. Josh Hicks actually talks about it in the interview we did with him. So, yeah. John Sims is a friend of his, apparently. So there you go.
Next up is SB 48. That's the child marriage bill. That would prevent marriage under 18 in most circumstances, but 17-year-olds would have to get parental consent and judicial approval. This was the bill that kind of raised a lot of national attention because people were like, they're going to let kids get married in Kentucky. This bill's dead. But it wasn't. It passed 34-3 in the Senate, 87-0 in the House, signed by the governor on March 29th.
Yeah, very early in the session relative to everything else.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. HB 1, that's the foster care and adoption bill. This was a bill that we did a segment on that had bipartisan support, included some good things, but maybe also some bad things, at least in my opinion. It terminates rights for drug addicted mothers, streamlines the adoption process and appeals process a little bit, creates the putative father registry and expanded boards, and allowed for a study for privatizing foster care.
Right.
So that bill passed the House 94-1. The no vote was Attica Scott.
Who said, I think she said she did that because of the putative father registry and some foster care stuff.
Yes, exactly. And it passed the Senate on April 2nd, and that bill has been delivered to the governor's desk.
Yeah, so he'll either sign it or not veto it before the end of the week.
Correct.
Yeah.
Senate Bill 3, Marcy's Law, another bill that I was very passionate about. This is the bill that gives victims the right to sue and other rights that already existed that they now have standing to bring lawsuits in court over. So that was passed and delivered to the Secretary of State on January 25th. So a little bit different because it's a constitutional amendment. So once that passes both houses, it goes to the Secretary of State. That happened way back in January, and it'll be on the ballot because it has to be voted on to amend the Constitution.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many constitutional amendments actually passed all the way through, but the Secretary of State gets to pick two. It's highly likely that she will pick this one, though.
I think so, yeah. As well. This movement had a lot of funding. It was passed very early on in the session.
Right.
Will probably be on the ballot in November.
Mm-hmm.
HB 227, this was a solar panel bill that would make pretty severe cuts to the net metering program. Robert talked about that several weeks ago on the podcast. It passed barely 49-45 in the House. It had two readings in the Senate and was reported favorably. That's where it kind of stopped.
Right. This is another one that is on the watch list. It's poised to pass the Senate, and if it does, it will then be able to just be signed into law. So it's something that could certainly pass in the past 2 days.
Mm-hmm. HB 98, that was a bill about Louisville elections. Several months ago, we talked about a lot of Louisville Metro Council drama with council,
right,
former council member Dan Johnson, who was ousted. This bill required a Metro Council special election within 60 days, as opposed to the council nominating and appointing a new member.
Mm-hmm.
Attica Scott had concerns about the time that a special election would take, the cost of that, and the disadvantage that some lesser known candidates might have.
Right. She pointed out when she was placed on the Metro Council, it was through this process. and then she didn't win the election. So there you go.
Right. That bill was recommitted to appropriations and revenue back in February.
So it's
and that
likely.
Was the last action.
Yeah, it's not going to pass.
No, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
Senate Bill 2, that's a tort reform bill from Ralph Alvarado.
Mm-hmm.
That bill was a damage cap on torts. It had two readings. It was passed over several times and then recommitted to the state and local government committee.
Which probably means it's dead because it would have to pass both houses.
Correct.
Yeah.
Another Ralph Alvarado tort bill, Senate Bill 20. That's the bill that would do a lot of different things to reform tort law. It would require Med-Mal suits to have an affidavit of merit. It would cap attorney's fees, exempt peer review from discovery, regulate copying records, and it would keep apologies like saying I'm sorry from being used against a medical provider in court. That bill passed the Senate 20-16, and it was received in the House and posted in committee on March 9th, and that was the last action.
Unless they really wanted to fast track it, it would be difficult. And the fact that it was even close as a vote in the Senate probably means
more conservative Senate.
Right, exactly.
HB 23, this was a bill that would align state elections with presidential elections. It was filed in the House. It had two readings and then a floor amendment filed on March 15th that would make the law begin in 2022 instead of 2024. And it changes some of the offices, the state offices that were included in the bill.
So that probably means this is not going to happen.
Probably not.
Yeah.
HB 10. This would allow the legislature to review and overturn administrative regulations. We didn't do a full segment on this, but it is a bill that we mentioned in one episode. That gives the legislature quite a bit of power over
right.
executive agencies.
Which is appropriate, I feel like, but, you know, what are you going to do?
Agencies that are supposed to have some independence. So
right.
I don't, you know, I'm not real sure about that one. It passed in the House. It was received in the Senate back in February.
Probably too low profile to pass, I would say.
Yeah,
but
I think so, too. Uh-huh. Those are all of the bills that we talked about in the podcast. It doesn't seem like a lot of stuff passed, right, of everything that we talked about. But there's still time, especially for the net metering bill, for the gang bill. But just looking at bills that actually passed both houses that have been delivered to the governor, an abstinence education bill
right.
passed, mm-hmm. a road plan, a bill to ensure independent pharmacies are reimbursed for filling Medicaid prescriptions.
That was actually a bill that got a lot of national attention for people who are interested in healthcare. We should probably talk mm-hmm. about that at some point in the future. It's a big bill.
A bourbon by mail bill, which I think is a good thing. I think we were one of the states where you cannot mail alcohol.
Right.
And so this will be good for the bourbon industry.
Is it just bourbon, though? I have lots of friends that are like, I can't be in a wine club. I even have one friend that has receives a wine club subscription at a P.O. box in Indiana. So
yeah. I haven't read the bill, but it was called a bourbon by mail bill.
Right.
So I'm assuming it's just bourbon
just
for
bourbon.
Now.
Okay.
A bill that exempts some body cam footage from being released to the public, which I don't. This is obviously isn't all body cam footage. It's footage that like shows the inside of a private home,
right.
Or footage that shows like a dead body. So some of that it's probably a good idea to not release. So mm-hmm. That passed. An abortion bill that prevents dilation and evacuation procedures after 11 weeks.
Which will get challenged in court and probably overturned.
Probably so. Yeah. A bill that creates a claim for damages against a terrorist in state court. And a financial literacy bill requiring high school students to pass a course before graduating. My mom was always in favor of that. She would always say that every high schooler needs to take some kind of finance class.
Yeah.
I didn't. So maybe she was trying to get me to take one.
How are your finances?
And finally, a revenge porn bill passed as well.
Right.
So there are others, but those are among some of the ones that did pass. And then a lot of things just kind of died.
Well, yeah. Well, it's good to know what to be on the watch for. There are two legislative days left. They will be Friday and Saturday. So be paying attention to see if any of these things do make it out. The main things that I think will be taken up in the session on Friday and Saturday are veto override. So we are coming out of this veto period. They call it the veto period. It's the days before the last 2 days of legislative session where the governor has the chance to either sign bills into law or veto them. Matt Bevin, you mentioned this at the very beginning of your segment, but he has been hard at work over this period, and I wanted to talk about a couple of things he vetoed and a couple of things he signed in a little bit more detail. So Matt Bevin actually vetoed the revenue bill, HB 366. He also vetoed a bill allowing for the phase-in of pension obligations, which was HB 362. And then he vetoed the entire state budget, HB 200. And we'll talk a little bit about all three of these in a little bit of detail. The first one I wanted to talk about was HB 362. It got overlooked a little bit by us in the flurry activity last week, but it is an important bill that we need to make sure you guys are aware of. So HB 362, it allows for the phase-in of pension obligations for entities like cities and other state employers, police departments, libraries, etc. A few months ago, we talked about how pension obligations were calculated and how the Bevin administration was taking steps to be significantly more conservative about growth estimates. Yeah, I think that the Bashir administration and other administrations prior to Matt Bevin had a more aggressive, you know, saying that the amount that would grow would be higher. And Matt Bevin's administration is pushing that number down. And by doing that, it's led to higher and higher annual obligations that have been projected. Add that to this new level dollar approach, which is being favored by the legislature and Matt Bevin, and you get the recipe for much more money being required from cities and employers as their portion of the pension obligations. The city of Louisville alone is facing a $38 million increase in obligations in a single year. That would have really busted the city's budget. That's a huge chunk of money that the city of Louisville would owe. So enter HB 362. The main provision of this bill ensures that no CERS employer, which is basically any employer in the pension system, can see their obligations grow by more than 12% a year. So basically, you'd have like several 12% increases stacked up year after year until you got to the level of funding that was required, and then they would pay that into the future. So it's a phase-in. It'd be phasing it in. However, the bill also provided a framework for small employers like libraries and community health centers that would allow those groups to buy themselves out of the state pension and start their own retirement systems, offer their own benefits, that sort of thing. The governor vetoed this bill, and what he said was he did support the phase-in, but he vetoed the bill because of cash flow issues and a shift in obligations to taxpayers due to the buyout provisions for some of these smaller groups. You know, whatever. These small groups, they don't have that much money in the pension system. They're basically beholden to a big kind of wonky, some people would argue broken system. But the governor said, you know, it would be fiscally irresponsible to allow those things to happen. He encouraged the legislature to reenact the bill's phase-in provisions without the language about buyouts. Acting Speaker Osborne said that they would consider that, but then he said, quote, members believe all provisions of the bill are important. So
that's they're gonna acting speaker from his own party.
Right. They're going to override this veto, it looks like. In addition to that bill, I wanted to let you guys know about that bill, which was vetoed after it was passed. The governor also vetoed the revenue and the entire state budget. So if the governor wanted to veto the revenue bill, he had to do it totally. He could only just totally veto the bill, like every other bill. It wasn't eligible for a line item veto. And honestly, it's not that surprising to me that the governor vetoed the revenue bill. Its approach to taxes was pretty slapped together, and it's an easy target for criticism from Republicans and Democrats. It's somewhat surprising, I guess, maybe because the bill does include a flat tax, which is something that conservatives like Matt Bevin support.
Right.
Yeah. However, the governor made clear that he wanted a wholesale approach to tax reform. That's what he kind of said when he vetoed it. Honestly, he should. He should want that because the government is totally run by the Republicans, and a structured tax plan that you think through totally and come out with after you've thought about it for more than, you know, a weekend is something that they should be able to accomplish. We have complete control over the government. And this last second, last ditch piecemeal bill isn't going to cut it with Matt Bevin. So, and I think that he is scoring some points because nobody really liked this outside of the Republican legislature. In addition, the governor entirely vetoed the state budget.
So this is what was really crazy to me.
Yes, me too. It was very surprising because the governor has the ability to do a line item veto on the budget. You know, the line item veto allows the governor to explicitly state what he supports and does not support in the budget. Major provisions of his own budget plan are included in HB 200, which was passed. So it's kind of interesting that he decided to veto the whole thing instead of just the portions that he disagreed with. It seemed to me as though the wholesale veto was two things. First of all, it was an acknowledgement that the veto pin is pretty useless, as the legislature only requires a 50% plus one vote to override vetoes. Who cares? You can veto it. It's just going to get overridden anyway. And also, secondly, the governor is expressing frustration at the tactics of the legislature. Like more liberal folks, I think he seems to take issue with the last second tactics of the legislature and got very mad at them for the way that they wanted to pass these bills. I think that he's basically making a stand against the things that were done in the legislature in the last couple of days. Republicans, in addition to Democrats, are pretty frustrated by that.
And I'm guessing you're going to get to that soon, but Republicans are also frustrated at how he's handled all
absolutely
of this, right?
So yeah, absolutely. So there were a lot of fireworks that happened. So the governor let loose on the legislature on April 9th with language he often reserves for his true enemies, such as teachers and union workers. This is what he said, quote, there are many legislators who just don't understand this. They don't. They're smart people, they're intelligent people, they're educated people on many fronts. They don't understand finance, they don't understand pensions, and yet they're the ones who are going to have to make decisions, unquote. Do you think my Matt Bevin impression was good?
It wasn't perfect, but it was pretty good.
Okay. Well, like I said, his true enemies, such as teachers and union workers, are the people who typically get this type of tongue lashing.
Very common enemies, teachers and laborers, right?
Right. The legislature, though, they responded in kind. Senate President Robert Stivers and Acting Speaker David Osborne, they released a statement saying, quote, "We believe Governor Bevin is misguided in his interpretation of the budget and revenue bills, as we are comfortable with LRC staff revenue projections," and we'll get to that in a second. "To our knowledge, the governor has had no discussions with any legislators on the details of this budget and what he might consider to be a shortfall. We believe Governor Bevin would be best served to meet with legislators and understand their thoughts and rationale before making a final decision on vetoing the revenue and or budget bills," unquote.
And then he definitely didn't do that. He vetoed it anyway.
He vetoed it anyway.
They invited him to meet with them.
Yeah. And it sounds like that they are, everybody in the Republican Party is just mad that they're not talking to each other and not doing what the other one wants them to do. So, dysfunction. Yeah. So there's ample speculation that the governor might also veto Senate Bill 151, the pension sewer bill. However, on Tuesday the 10th, he signed it into law. He said, quote, "Is the bill what it could have been and should have been and ultimately needs to be? No. But it's a very good bill, and there's nothing in it that's bad for Kentucky." Absolutely. That wasn't a very good Matt Bevin impression either. He also said that the bill, quote, "doesn't even come close." Just as a reminder, according to the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy, as long as the legislature continues to fund the full ARC, the systems would have will have returned to good health without any benefit cuts. So, and also, just as a last second note, Andy Beshear and a couple of unions filed suit against HB 151 today. So,
as he promised.
Yeah, as he promised he would. Okay, Jasmine, a couple of other things. We talked a little bit about the LRC that was mentioned by the legislature. So one of the reasons the governor decided to veto the budget was that his budget director, John Chilton, stated that the revenue projections by the LRC were wrong and would produce $50 million less than what they were predicted to over the biennium. Mr. Chilton stated that the typical process for scoring a revenue bill like HB 366 is for the LRC to work with the Office of the State Budget Director, which would be his office, and the Department of Revenue, and make sure that everybody's kind of on the same page and agreed on the projection. Obviously, since this bill was released at the last second and in a shock to everybody but Republican legislators, this process didn't happen. Mr. Chilton said that the process of predicting how much revenue a revenue bill will produce is especially hard when taxes are going both up and down simultaneously. So we are raising some excise taxes and some service taxes while we're decreasing some income taxes. And yes, that is indeed very difficult. Jasmine, you often talk about things that you had to learn in law school that were very difficult. Mm-hmm. I learned how to do this in grad school, and I can now tell you that is very hard to do. Mr. Chilton, after consulting with the LRC, he thinks that the bills will produce less revenue than what the LRC thinks. And honestly, he's probably not wrong. We've been through the process in which the governor's office has to make cuts based on revenue not meeting the budget expectations. We've talked about this on the show a couple times. Several years in a row we've had to do this, including every year of the Bevin administration. So as the statement above by the legislature says, the legislature stands by the LRC and it looks likely to override the governor's veto of the budget and revenue bills anyway. It's a very delicate compromise they seem to have struck, and I think that they are invested in making sure it goes forward. So, Jasmine, goodness.
So much is happening.
There is, but there's Quick Hits too. We got Quick Hits.
Oh, we have Quick Hits?
Yeah, we do. We do. Okay. Representative Jeff Hoover's saga with the Kentucky Legislative Ethics Commission is over. He's agreed to a fine of $1,000 and a public reprimand. The deal he made with his accuser will remain a secret, and he is allowed to keep his seat. He was evasive when asked if he would run for speaker or GOP leader again. Do you think he'll do it?
I don't know. He seems to have like quite a bit of pride. So yeah. He might. I mean, he doesn't have an opponent to keep his seat.
Yeah, there's a lot of the opponents, the people who didn't have opponents, they drew write-in opponents there at the last second, and he is not one of the people who got a write-in opponent. He's worked so hard and as a Republican for very long to get into the majority and get into leadership. I would be surprised if he didn't try again. That's just me, though.
Yeah.
Okay, last thing. Eastern Kentucky University is eliminating 153 jobs, including their theater and economics program and their tennis team. So that's like both me and my sister. I'm an economics person.
I was a theater person. Yeah.
Well, there you go. They're attacking us, Jasmine. EKU is facing a $25 million shortfall, which was a product of declining enrollment, increasing pension obligations, and declining state support. So really crappy time there in Richmond.
Sad
so.
Last quick hit.
Yeah, it is. Last quick hits are often very sad, though. Jasmine, we have an interview with Josh Hicks. I thought it went really well. He was very passionate and had a lot to say, so I'm excited for you guys to listen to it. So let's do that right now.
Josh Hicks is a candidate for the Kentucky House of Representatives in the 45th District, which is the southwest corner of Fayette County. So we have now interviewed all the Democrats seeking to represent Bluegrass Airport. Mr. Hicks is a former U.S. Marine police officer and lawyer who is a first-time candidate for the House. He's originally from Texas, but he spent time all over the state of Kentucky, having grown up partially in Fleming County, attending school in Georgetown, Moorhead, and Lexington, and serving on the police force in Maysville. The 45th District is currently represented by Stan Lee, one of the most conservative members in the Kentucky House, who has served since 2001. So, Josh Hicks, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Thank you so much, Jasmine. And if there's any background noise or if I'm not coming through clearly, I apologize. I wanted to be there in the studio in person, but as I'm sure you and maybe your listeners are aware, today on the 11th, Fayette County teachers from the 45th are holding a rally out here at Beaumont Center here at Harrodsburg Road that's pretty well attended. And I've tried to duck into a vehicle here where I can be heard a little more clearly. But if you get some honks and things, it's our great citizens of the 45th supporting our teachers.
Well, while we would have loved to have you in studio in person today, we're happy to accommodate for you to attend that. So you're running against one of the most entrenched members of the Republican caucus, someone who has rarely faced serious opposition. Why did you decide to enter this race, and what makes you think that you can win it?
Well, as to your first question, why did I decide to enter the race? I think you've probably heard this from a number of new candidates this year, but I'm extremely unsatisfied with the way government appears to be run now. And when you look around and you think to yourself, what can I as a private citizen do to change this? How can I most affect change? For me, the answer was I can run for office. I believe I'm a good public speaker. I believe I have good leadership training from my time in the Marine Corps. I have been a public servant for nearly a decade, both as a United States Marine and as a police officer in Maysville. And I just feel like I have the ability to help and solve some of these problems I think are endemic in our government today.
I think that you share a similar sentiment to a lot of candidates that we've interviewed, and it's very cool that you have experience in so many different areas as a public servant, and you've kind of been all over the state, too.
I have been. You know, my law practice, and this is probably an old worn saw, but my law practice has taken me from Pikeville to Paducah. I went to high school in Fleming County and grew up in that Fleming County, Lewis County, Mason County area. I went off and joined the Marine Corps, but when I came home, my wife's family is from Maysville, so I went back and became a Maysville police officer. I've spent time, as you said, at Moorhead State, at Georgetown College, and at the University of Kentucky, and now I've lived here in Lexington since 2008, and frankly, that breadth of experience all around the state has given me a feel for maybe what someone like me could do to help the working people, the everyday Kentuckian, if I'm elected to state government.
Absolutely. So you've given your campaign $10,000, which signals to us that you're really serious about running this race and willing to do what it takes to win. Do you think Stan Lee is taking your challenge seriously?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I'll tell you this. He should be taking it seriously because I'm a serious person. This is not a race for vanity. This is not a race for any reason other than to take my leadership capability and my beliefs to Frankfort and put them to work for people. You know, it seems like government has moved away from being of the people, for the people, and more of the wealthy or those who have been purchased by the wealthy and for the wealthy. And going back to your earlier question, why did you run? Why was I so angry? I'm sick of seeing millionaires and billionaires and the puppets of those people be the only ones who can afford to run for office. And I have strong beliefs, and I'm not afraid to share them with people. And I thought, if I have this money, and my wife, of course, blessed this when we talked about it, if I have the capability to do this and go and enact some change so that regular, everyday people can run for office and win, then that's what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great to hear that, you know, we have so many serious Democratic candidates this year. But Representative Lee won his election in 2016 pretty handily. It was about 60-40%. Even so, 2016 was the stiffest Democratic competition that he'd ever faced. He often doesn't even have an opponent. However, Jim Gray got more votes in District 45 than Rand Paul. Do you think that this district is ready to elect a Democrat?
I absolutely think it's ready to elect a Democrat, especially one like me who supports public education, who supports, you know, building and supporting a working class, making sure our retirees aren't stuck in a regressive tax loop. And frankly, I don't think it's as much about party as it is about experience, because what we're seeing now under complete Republican control is that all of these fantasies they talked about once they would have control are not really coming true. Actually, what's happening is it's a raid on the public coffers, and we're trying to implement charter schools so that private entities can profit off of tax dollars. We're attempting to do tax giveaways in the form of vouchers to hurt our public schools. We're raising taxes on the 95% of Kentuckians while giving $500 million in tax breaks to the 5%, to the top 5% of corporations and wealthy Kentuckians. And frankly, I think people in the 45th and all around the state are seeing that these pipe dreams that the Republicans told them, this fiscal conservatism myth that a lot of these representative and elective office holders have, is not true. And they're starting to see through that fabrication. And that's going to put candidates who are really ready to go and implement systems and revenue programs and a taxation scheme that works for the many instead of the few. I think we're going to see that wave and push towards candidates who will push that kind of policy.
One of the major themes that we have seen in American elections over the past several years is that Democrats are making serious inroads with voters in suburban districts like the 45th. Do you think that these national trends are playing out in Lexington? I heard you talk a little bit about education and about issues that affect working people, but what do you think it is that makes Democrats more attractive to voters in the 45th today versus where they were a decade or two ago?
Well, I think it's going back to my earlier answer. I think it's become apparent that these sort of trickle-down economic policies are all just fantasy, that giving rich people more money does not necessarily inure to the benefit of working-class people. I think that's part of it. But I can't consider Democrats as just a monolith, because there's plenty of Democrats nationwide that make votes that run fundamentally against what I believe. And so I think that Democrats have become, at least in current politics, and this is state and federal, I think they've at least become a party where we're fighting back against this constant corporate welfare culture where our wealthiest Americans, our wealthiest Kentuckians, our wealthiest corporations have gotten addicted to these tax dollars, and they've purchased representatives, they've purchased legislators to give them the legislation that will help fatten their pockets. I think people are starting to see the result of these policies. They're starting to see, you know, what happened in Kansas under Brownback, and that terrible tax scheme was all a fraud, and now their public education system is failing. And in Oklahoma, where, you know, the regressive tax scheme was put in place and the wealthiest were given these giant handouts, and now their public education system, their state, is just absolutely falling apart. I think that Democrats are able to say this is not what we ever wanted. And those Democrats who stood strongly against those policies, I think, will do very well. And the fact that I hope this party seems to be shifting back towards policies that stop the wealthy welfare will really allow us to take back the levers of control and start putting plans in place that will really help people.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I think that those are very key issues that people in all areas, but especially areas like the 45th, are really going to be passionate about. So you're actually the first candidate that we've spoken to since the sewage or pension bill and the budget were passed through the legislature. And it's been kind of interesting since that happened, where the Republicans, they don't seem to be too interested in defending their tactics, you know, having things pushed through on the last day, getting rid of this sewage bill and inserting a pension bill. But one of the things they're quick to say is, you know, well, the Democrats, they used to do this too. And I don't think their arguments are going to really win any rhetorical prizes, but they do kind of have a point in that Democrats did used to do this kind of thing. You've talked a little bit about how Democrats, how it's not about party for you, and how, you know, you want to stand on the issues that you think are important to you. But what do you say about how the Democrats should run Frankfort if they are indeed given the majority next year?
Well, I think it's I think it's apparent from candidates like me that once we're in Frankfort, we're not going to be a party to this complete lack of transparency, this railroading, this ramrodding, this secret backroom dealing. And if I had a message for the Democrats who are now sort of trying to figure out how to explain the things that they did in the past, it would be to say, just say that we now recognize that this is a problem for voters in today's climate, because frankly, this whole lack of transparency, what happened in that committee meeting over this sewage bill, over this pension bill, the 8 minutes of lack of debate and clear illegality of what was happening, that needs to be broadcast far and wide. And if we as a Democratic Party learn anything from this, it's that we have to be the champions of transparency. We have to be the champions of open government, because it's now apparent that the people in control of Frankfort now will not only use these tactics to ram through bad legislation that hurts people, but then defend it by saying it used to happen. And mm-hmm. all that means for people like me is that when I'm in Frankfort, I cannot allow that to happen from my party or any other party.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's absolutely, I certainly hope that whoever's in charge doesn't do these things again. That's been kind of shameful, and it's been shameful for a while, so I'm kind of glad that everybody's waking up to this. Tactics aside, though, from a policy perspective, the pension bill, it managed to cut benefits for future teachers without taking much of a bite out of our long-term obligations in terms of what we owe, and the budget includes major cuts to necessary services, and the revenue plan cuts taxes for the rich while raising taxes for everybody else. And you know, we've talked a lot about that on our show. Tell us about how you hope the Democrats address the mess that we've made beyond, you know, just saying this is all bad. What are some things that you hope that the Democrats do to address these types of issues going forward?
Well, you know, we have to become, once we are back in control of Frankfort, we have to become the party of revenue. We have to figure out the revenue issue. And from a policy perspective, what that means is you will never, ever, ever cut your way to prosperity. That this austerity mindset that was created in the 90s with third wayism and is now propagated all the way up nationally and here locally, you cannot give away $13 billion in tax cuts a year and then expect teachers and firefighters and police officers to swallow your line of rhetoric when you go and tell them that they're the ones that have to make sacrifices.
Right.
Because no one is going to the corporate beneficiary of billions of dollars of tax breaks and saying, you need to make sacrifices. And in my mind, that's a problem. From a policy perspective, the people who we need to approach about our revenue issues are the people who have the most to give. Mm-hmm. We can't go to the teacher who's been buying classroom supplies out of her pocket for the last 15 years and tell her she needs to pay more for her health insurance, or that she needs to take a pay cut or not get a cost of living increase when she retires or give up her pension entirely. We can't go to that police officer or that police department and say, sorry, no more hazardous duty retirees for you, because you have to make sacrifices, if we're not also willing to go to the wealthiest Kentuckians and say, it's time to be good corporate and wealthy citizens and to pay your fair share.
Right. That's absolutely true. Yeah, and at this point in the show, we usually ask about HB 29, which is Jim Wayne's revenue bill that was also co-sponsored by a million other people. Obviously, that bill is going to be different next year, since some of it was taken up into law already. But it sounds like you're already very passionate about Kentucky's needs for more revenue, which is what, you know, I think is the most important thing for Democrats to have going forward. So I'm really excited to hear you say that. So that's great. That's a great answer to that question. But beyond revenue and beyond budget, you know, these are major issues that we've been talking about in big ways this year, but those are not the only things that are issues that are in front of the legislature in Frankfort. Tell us a little bit about what other issues that you're particularly passionate about.
I'll tell you, this is going to run along a theme, and I'll tell you, one of the things that has really caught my eye from this past legislative session, and it includes James Kay's amendment to SB 151 or attempted amendment to SB 151, is transparency. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a serious lack of transparency in Frankfort, and I'm not gonna put that on one party or another. But I will say that I am a candidate who pledges to go to Frankfort and fight every single day for transparency in our legislative process, for transparency in our investment, our pension investment process, for transparency in lawmaking and bill building and in craftsmanship. And really to strengthen up the ethical guidelines that are there, I know, Robert, your listeners are probably aware of the attempts to change some of the Legislative Ethics Commission rules about accepting donations and things from lobbies. And the fact that that was sort of summarily struck down by an offhanded comment that you know, this would mean that lobbyists couldn't buy a legislator a cup of coffee, I think that's the way it should be.
Right.
If we have legislators who are there to represent the will of their constituency, lobbyists should only be able to influence the process to the extent that they have a great idea that right. they're bringing into someone's office in a fully fair and transparent manner and presenting in such a way that it's shown to benefit all Kentuckians. Because if lobbying is happening over cups of coffee or steak dinners or Keeneland trips or football tailgates or whatever way they're happening now, then that's the exact thing we should seek to avoid. It is one of the issues I have with government now is that it seems to be bought and paid for. It seems that the wealthy have such a leg up in getting the bills passed that benefit them and harm everybody else. So transparency is one of my big issues. From a bill perspective, some of the things we saw go through, you know, I have a high school classmate who's currently the representative from the 70th District, John Sims, and he put forward a medical marijuana bill that ended up with, I don't know, 25, 26 co-sponsors, bipartisan support. And although it had all of this great support and momentum, it just sort of died in committee. And I think that's a shame. I think this is a state that's ready for medical marijuana. I think as a veteran myself, I've been approached by numerous veterans advocacy groups and have frankly done the research myself to see that this can not only help the veterans that we have in Kentucky, the veterans that suffer from illnesses and are addicted to prescription pills and sort of under the thumb of Big Pharma, but we've seen this 25% to 35% decrease in opioid overdose deaths in states that have legalized medical cannabis. And it just, for me, Robert, it seems like it's a no-brainer. It's right. something that I think has majority support across the Commonwealth. And for it not to even get out of committee and force the entire legislative body to put their votes on the record so that the voters would know in November, I think that's a shame.
Right. It's so interesting to see how that issue's evolved, where now it seems that for the longest time, you know, more conservative people wanted Democrats to go on the record with their opinions on marijuana. Now it's kind of the opposite, where Democrats are wanting Republicans to go on the record about their opposition to it. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right on about that, and excited to hear that. I think Representative Sims' bill has a good chance in future sessions, and I think it will have an even better chance if you make it to Frankfort. So, all right, well, thank you so much for joining us here on My Old Kentucky Podcast, and, you know, we really appreciate you coming on.
Robert and Jasmine, I thank you so much for your time. If any of your listeners want to learn a little bit more about me, please feel free to visit www.joshhicks4ky.com. Follow me on Facebook or Twitter. I put out things almost every day. And thank you for this opportunity. I look forward to listening to this when it comes out.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod. We have a Facebook page. We post our show notes on Medium, and you can find our podcast on the podcast app of your choice.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.